Welcome back, one and all, to In Summation, The Final Word. I'm Paul Townsend, your host in this experiment, back for another episode. I want to take this time to say thank you to the Political Orphanage Discord members who've messaged me in the few days leading up to recording this episode. Not too long ago, I was invited by Andrew Heaton, a political satirist and commentator, to get interviewed on his podcast, The Political Orphanage, about plea bargaining and whether it's a tool used by prosecutors to coerce excessive punishments or a useful option to give criminal defendants the benefit of being able to bargain down to a lesser penalty. After that, I joined the Discord for his show and had a very interesting chat with some of his listeners who had a lot of really intelligent questions and insights and who sent me some messages and questions about my show as well. So welcome, and please keep the questions coming. Today's episode is going to touch on a topic which I've received a decent amount of questions about in the past. It's been part of several shows, but it's been pointed out to me that I've never really taken the time to really explain the ins and outs, the theory behind, and the mechanics of introducing expert testimony. We're going to focus today on deoxyribonucleic acid, also called DNA, because that's always a hot topic. But in doing so, we're going to be covering expert testimony generally, which would apply to really any expert that a party wants to put on in a criminal trial. At this point, DNA testing has become relatively common. It sits in a prominent place in how we, as a society, view law enforcement. DNA evidence is like the holy grail of crime scene assessments. In our collective minds, here in 2022, DNA evidence essentially means incontrovertible proof. It is seen as close to metaphysical certainty as we can get in this life. We trust it. We believe the crime lab techs and the criminalists who take the stand and drone on and on about alleles and sequencing and short tandem repeats and other phrases that make no sense to the average juror. But in the end, that doesn't really matter, because they always spit out some obscene number with respect to the chances that the DNA sample does not match the subject. In a case I have that's coming up for trial soon, the DNA analysis claims that's a 1 in 348 billion chance that the DNA does not match my client. 1 in 348 billion chance that it's wrong. Considering the Earth's population is just shy of 8 billion people, that means it would take roughly 43 and a half Earths to find another individual who fits the DNA profile that matches my crime scene evidence. But few of us take a minute to reflect on how we got here. Most people know DNA evidence is relatively recent, though by now it's old enough to be considered a part of life without giving too much thought into the novelty of it. So today, I'd like to change that for you. We're going to take a look at the first criminal case in the United States to use DNA testing to argue that certain fluids left during the commission of a crime belong to a certain individual who was identified after the fact. In May 1986, a man in Orange County, Florida, which comprises Orlando and the surrounding area, broke into a woman's apartment through a window and raped her at knife point. The attacker didn't wear a mask. His victim was able to clearly see him, albeit briefly, but he was a stranger. He didn't use a condom and left some biological materials at the scene. At the time, he reasonably felt as though there would probably be no way to track him. But through the intersection of cutting-edge science and the creativity of one young assistant state prosecutor in Florida, this man would become a test subject, a guinea pig, for significant changes to criminal prosecution. This is the state of Florida versus Tommy Lee Andrews. We know that Tommy Lee Andrews was born in 1963, which would have made him 22 years old in February of 1986, when he's alleged to have raped a woman named Nancy Hodge. Background on Andrews is fairly slim. I spent a lot of time researching what I could find. Mostly what I came across were just bylines about how he was the introductory case for DNA profiling in the United States. Now, I was able to find some reputable sources which gave a bit of background on the case, but very little on his childhood and upbringing. It seems from one source I read that he was born and lived in Florida his whole life, though I wasn't really able to confirm that. What we do know is that he was in Orange County in 1986, which is where our story principally begins. Tommy Lee Andrews was a sexual predator. He is known as a serial rapist. Some records I looked at identified him as an attacker in up to 23 sexual assaults. As a quick aside, both personally and professionally, I find rape, sexual assault, and child pornography cases to be the most difficult categories of cases to work on. In my career as a defense attorney, I've seen that I can get people to understand murder. I can get people to understand drug dealing, or fraud, money laundering, or whatever. I can boil those cases down to the base emotions involved. You can get a jury to understand homicide because they understand anger or jealousy. They intrinsically identify with the emotion of just snapping, temporarily losing control, doing something bad. That obviously doesn't mean that the actions don't get punished, but you can garner some sympathy and understanding from a judge or a jury who can put themselves in the defendant's position. Lashing out, while still very much illegal if it involves intentional homicide, is something which is at the very least explainable. The same goes for greed. I understand greed. You understand greed. Juries understand greed. People sell drugs to make money. Drug dealing can be lucrative. Same goes for fraud, embezzlement, money laundering. It's all driven by a desire to increase wealth. Deep down, that is an understandable feeling. You and I might never follow that path, but we can appreciate the mindset that drives someone to commit these crimes. Sex crimes are both the same, but also very different. They're the same in that they can largely be boiled down, but this time, it's to power. It's the act of control that drives most sex crimes. It's feeling dominant and imposing your will onto another person when they don't want it. And it's that imposition that sets it apart from other crimes. Now, obviously, nobody wants to be shot or stabbed or otherwise injured or killed. But to society, sex crimes involve violating not just another person's body, but their very personhood. It's a bridge too far for many people. They fundamentally just cannot understand how a person could do that to someone else because they find it debasing. Because of that, sex crimes trials are, on average, harder to win than murder or money laundering. People are also more willing to abandon the presumption of innocence in rape or sexual assault cases. The mere fact that someone is accused of such behavior, meaning that someone out there believes them capable of it, is enough to turn the general population's stomach in knots. I think there's a significant link between society's inability to wrap their heads around sexual violence and the instantaneous feelings of guilt and condemnation for those accused, whether credibly or not. If you look back at episode 13, we discussed the Duke lacrosse players who were accused of raping an exotic dancer at a party. It is impossible to forget the national outrage that was directed at them, at times even after they had been cleared of the act. So both personally and professionally, they're tough cases. I know some defense lawyers who just don't take them. Having tried cases where my clients are accused of rape or child pornography, I can say that they can weigh on you, even if you have faith in your client's innocence. Today we're talking about Tommy Lee Andrews. He, as I mentioned before, is a serial rapist. In May of 1986, he broke into Nancy Hodge's apartment through a window and raped her at knife point. Andrews did not wear a mask, but Hodge had never met him before, didn't know his name. She was asleep when he jumped on top of her, held a knife to the back of her neck, raped her, and then stole her purse as he left. Hodge reported the crime, and the evidence collection team responded to her apartment. Since Andrews was a complete stranger to her, all she could really say was that her attacker was a strong African-American male who looked to be in his early 20s. Evidence collection did manage to lift a fingerprint from the windowsill. But in 1986, with no suspect to compare it to, it really wasn't all that helpful. Hodge was taken to the hospital where, we don't want to get too graphic, but semen was recovered. Between May 1986 and January of 1997, there were an additional 22 rapes or attempted sexual assaults in a relatively confined area of Orange County, close to the vicinity of Hodge's home. The methodology was always the same. The attacker would break in through an unlocked window or door. He brought a knife. He wore a mask and was careful not to leave fingerprints. So the methodology was close to, but not exactly the same, as the Hodge attack. For nearly a year, there was no progress on solving Hodge's rape. Forensics back in 1986 were nowhere near what they are today. They did have a process called serology, which was a way to analyze proteins in bodily fluids. But the primitive serology techniques were nowhere near as exclusive as DNA testing would prove to be. It was really more useful to exclude people as subjects than to identify someone. Additionally, there was no serology database to compare a sample to. You had to have an actual donor in custody to make the comparison. So even that was of no use. Now, law enforcement got a breakthrough in March of 1987. A very observant Orange County woman was concerned by a prowler creeping around her neighborhood testing windows. She called the police, who promptly arrived and apprehended him. He was brought back to the station, arrested, and fingerprinted. The fingerprints matched those on the window pane of Nancy Hodge's window. And that man was Tommy Lee Andrews. Hodge was brought to the station, and despite it being nearly 10 months after her attack, she was able to identify Andrews. With Andrews in custody, prosecutors obtained a sample of saliva from a buccal swab, which is when a cotton swab is rubbed inside a person's cheek to collect saliva. The serology tests from the semen recovered from the Hodge attack, as well as the 22 others, matched Andrews. Though in all honesty, it wasn't selective enough to rule out a significant portion of the rest of the Orange County population. The case against Andrews for attacking Hodge was strong. They had the fingerprint, they had the identification, they had the serology. But prosecutors now believe that Andrews was responsible for approximately 23 different rapes or attempted sexual assaults. And the serology was the only thing that linked Andrews to the other 22 victims, since the subject wore a mask and left no fingerprints. The prosecutor on the case was a young man named Jeff Ashton. If you've been following the show from the beginning, or if you recently listened to some of the earlier episodes, the name might seem a bit familiar. He was the prosecutor in the Casey Anthony trial, which was one of the first episodes we covered on In Summation. But this is back in 1987. Jeff Ashton was a much younger man, an eager prosecutor, who felt a real sense of importance being assigned this case. Though Andrews was only initially charged with the Hodge attack, Ashton recognized that Andrews was a predator in the Orlando area, and winning this trial was necessary. He wanted to put forward the strongest case imaginable to ensure a conviction. As chance would have it, Ashton was reading a magazine and saw an advertisement for a company called the Life Codes Corporation. LifeCodes was a private company who utilized DNA testing to determine paternity. The company would take biological material from a child, typically saliva, and biological material from an adult, a prospective father, and generate a profile for each. They would make a comparison and see whether there is a match. 50% of a person's DNA comes from each parent. So when the scientists at LifeCodes examined the two profiles together, it was fairly easy to tell whether one comprised roughly 50% of the other. Let's quickly run through a crash course in how DNA evidence actually works. I'm sure it will not shock you to learn that there are multiple ways now of extracting and profiling DNA. But since we're discussing the Tommy Lee Andrews case, let's go through restriction fragment length polymorphism, because that's what they used back then. And it was really the introduction to extracting DNA and creating an individual unique profile. This is going to get a little technical, so don't worry if you miss something here. I'm including it only because in the emails I get, people generally want more detail. So this is how a DNA profile was created in 1987. The first thing a lab technician does is separate white and red blood cells by putting the fluid in a centrifuge, which spins a vial containing the sample incredibly fast so that material of varying weight and density is separated from each other. Then they extract DNA nuclei from the white blood cells. This is done by bathing the white blood cells in hot water, then adding salt, putting the mixture back in the centrifuge to spin again. At this point, the DNA strands will separate from the other matter in the cells. Then the DNA strands are cut into fragments using a restriction enzyme. The enzyme works to separate long strands into workable samples. The fragments are placed into one end of a bed of agarose gel, which has been fitted with electrodes. Agarose gel is made from agar-agar, a type of seaweed that turns into gelatin when dissolved in boiling water. The technician will then use an electric current to sort the DNA segments by length. This process is called agarose gel electrophoresis. Electrophoresis is the process of moving the negatively charged molecules through the gel with electricity. Shorter segments move farther away from the original location, while longer ones stay closer. The segments will naturally align in parallel rows. Finally, there will be a sheet of nitrocellulose, or nylon, to blot the DNA. The sheet is stained so that the different lengths of the DNA bands are visible to the naked eye. The sheet is treated with radiation, which creates an autoradiograph. This is basically an X-ray image left by the decay pattern from the radiation. The autoradiograph, with the distinctive dark-colored parallel bands, is the DNA profile. Those bands are unique for each individual person's DNA, so no two people outside of identical twins will have the same autoradiograph. Chances are, somewhere in pop culture, you have seen an autoradiograph. In shows like CSI, they appear on black lines which resemble a series of oddly spaced barcodes on transparent paper, which is then laid over a similar-looking sheet to see if the barcodes align. If they line up, there's a match. Even in 1987, when this was being done, the certainty rate was, on average, that there was a 1 in roughly 10 billion chance that another person could have a matching profile. There aren't, and there weren't, 10 billion people on the planet at that time, so it was a pretty high degree of scientific confidence, even if it's much more so now. That was the rate when a sufficient size sample could be attained to get a strong profile. The rate of certainty decreased if the sample was smaller because it generated less barcodes. Okay, so let's talk about how this whole scene played out, because it's really interesting. So Jeff Ashton, our prosecutor, sees a magazine ad for LifeCodes. He very sharply thinks to himself, if DNA can determine whether an adult's DNA matches a child to that absurdly high probability of certainty, Why can't prosecutors use the same technology to compare crime scene evidence to samples from suspects? Jeff Ashton goes to see his supervisor, Tim Barry, and lays out his new idea for how DNA testing the semen from the Hodge rape, and many other victims as well, would play against Tommy Lee Andrews' sample. Barry told Ashton to run with it. Ashton reached out to Lifecodes and eventually got on the phone with a man named Michael Baird, who was one of the senior scientists at the company. Baird agreed that DNA testing could be used to match DNA left at a crime scene to a suspect and was willing to get involved. Again, this is 1987. I should note here that while this is the first case in the United States to employ DNA evidence, it was not the first case globally, though neither Ashton nor Baird seems to have been aware of it. In 1984, in the United Kingdom, Sir Alec Jeffreys had independently developed his own method of DNA sequencing. In 1986, he was asked to compare DNA from a local Leicester bakery employee named Colin Pitchfork to DNA which was recovered at two separate murder scenes. His DNA was a match, and Pitchfork ended up pleading guilty to both murders. This is the earliest known use of DNA testing in criminal prosecutions globally, but the Andrews case is far more interesting. So Michael Baird is given a sample from the Hodge rape and from another attempted rape, a woman named Karen Monroe, and a sample from Andrews. No surprises, it's matches all around. But now we get to the real heart of the issue, the central question of this case. DNA testing is new. It's never been used in criminal cases in the United States with real-world outcomes. It was largely perceived by people who didn't understand it as a parlor trick to shame deadbeat fathers into paying child support. Would a criminal court allow Baird to testify and present DNA testing evidence in a serious sex offense case? Andrews was appointed defense lawyer Hal Urich. I don't want to spend too much time going off on tangents, but Hal Urich deserves a few minutes. Urich was a fairly seasoned defense attorney at the time he was appointed to represent Andrews. He was the kind of guy who pushed limits and really didn't have a lot of respect for the law, though he did have a strong courtroom presence and an ease with jurors. He was actually part of the defense team led by Don West and Mark O'Mara, who defended George Zimmerman, another insummation case study, though he had a relatively muted role in that case. Recently, in October of 2021, his fast and loose cavalier attitude finally caught up to him. Urich had formed a law firm called The Defense Group. Yeah, it's not a very creative name. The Defense Group had a client named Krishnauth Persaud, who is being investigated in late 2021 for raping a 9-year-old girl approximately 8 years prior. Urich quietly arranged a meeting between his client, the girl, who was then 17, and her father, where he was recorded instructing both the father and the victim on how to ignore a subpoena for testimony, or exactly how to lie to a grand jury and manipulate the Florida State's attorney's office into dropping the case. He's been charged with tampering with a witness and solicitation of perjury. But these charges are from 5 months ago, and he represented Tommy Lee Andrews roughly 35 years ago. Regardless, I wanted to give you a flavor of the kind of guy that Urich is. Looping the George Zimmerman case back in for just a moment, if you've listened to that episode, you know that Florida changed the standard for expert testimony in the middle of that trial, which resulted in some fairly serious implications for that case. But Zimmerman went to trial in 2013, which was decades after Andrews. Prior to 2013, Florida, like most other states, relied on the Fry test to determine whether an expert could testify. The Fry test is so named because it was developed out of the case Fry versus the United States, a federal criminal case in the District of Columbia, and it had been the law of the land since 1923. The Fry test was developed when James Fry wanted to introduce a polygraph examination, otherwise known as a lie detector test, in evidence in his murder trial. There was a hearing conducted to determine whether the evidence was reliable enough in the scientific community to be accepted by the court. The polygraph is the machine that hooks up to some wires placed on the subject, usually their finger and on some suction cups where it can measure bodily reactions, and then into the machine with the needle that oscillates back and forth while the examiner asks a series of yes and no questions and makes check marks on the graph that the needle is making. I'm confident that most of you will have the mental picture of the polygraph in your mind. The lie detector machines of the 1920s measured your blood pressure and pulse rate. The theory was that a person telling the truth wouldn't have to put any conscious energy into answering questions, because the truth would just kind of flow out of you. While a lie, since you have to fabricate the answer, will necessarily cause a spike in blood pressure and heart rate. It's an interesting theory, but it's never actually been recognized as good science. The DC court developed the test, which is now known as the Fry test, to evaluate whether this evidence would be admitted. Under the Fry test, expert evidence is only admissible when the scientific technique contemplated is generally accepted in the scientific community which it represents. In applying that test, the Fry court actually held that polygraphs failed the test. They are not generally held to be accepted as scientifically accurate. And I'm not aware of a single jurisdiction, nearly 100 years after this decision was given, which allows polygraph evidence to be offered to a jury. Ashton Urich prepared for battle on the Fry test analysis concerning DNA testing. There was a long, drawn-out pretrial hearing on the issue of the admissibility of this DNA evidence. Urich argued that Baird was just there to drum up media and business for the Life Coats Corporation. This was essentially free advertising for his junk science, and that his evidence would simply confuse the jury because nobody understands this wacky process that he described. Urich accused Ashton of trying to look like this technical process had been used when there was no way he could actually justify the degree of certainty he was claiming. Ashton brought not only Baird, who testified about the actual process of extracting and comparing DNA, but also an independent scientist who was an expert in the field to testify on the reliability of the scientific findings and the acceptance of DNA evidence in the community of identity comparison. The judge presided over the hearing made what I consider to be a fairly odd ruling. Ashton would be permitted to introduce the DNA evidence to say that a comparison of the DNA samples had been made, and Baird could testify that he had concluded that they were a match. But Baird was precluded from testifying about the statistical probability that the samples did not come from the same source. So essentially, Baird wasn't allowed to say that there was a 1 in 10 billion chance that the source came from someone else. I've put some thought into this ruling to try and make sense of it, and here's what I consider to be the most likely scenario. This is just my opinion, but I think this judge was probably completely turned around at the end of this hearing. I think the testimony regarding the Fry standard, the acceptance within the general scientific community, was probably enough to convince him that the methodology was sufficiently scientific, and that as far as paternity tests went, it was accepted regularly by family courts. Basically, it was clear that the scientific community accepted DNA comparisons and largely credited their results as accurate. But I also think the judge had a fundamental mistrust of the certainty of it all. DNA comparisons have become so commonplace now in our culture, from TV shows like CSI and Law & Order, that people my age have just grown up with this being a part of life. We just take it for granted that if the DNA comparison says match, that there's a 1 in a zillion % chance that it's mistaken. But I'm willing to bet that those of us who are naturally skeptical people by nature, if we were hearing all this mumbo jumbo about separating blood cells and radiating DNA particles and seaweed-based gelatinous goo, might not accept at first blush that it's basically infallible. We might say, okay, I understand that this is a hyper-technical process, and it's generally accepted and therefore admissible under Fry. There's just no way that it's that accurate. If one were to conclude that, one might rule that the comparison would be admissible, but that the statistical evidence would not be. So I personally think that's probably what happened here. The case moves on to trial. Ashton has the identification, he has the fingerprint, and he has the DNA comparison. And it's really fascinating how this case plays out. This would have been a pretty strong case against Andrews with just the identification and the fingerprint. Those two elements alone make for a pretty compelling argument that Andrews was the rapist. But Uhrig was a pretty shrewd defense attorney and recognized that if he made the entire case about the DNA, then a skeptical, uneducated jury might not understand the science and might be open to an argument that it's complete nonsense and that the prosecutor is trying to frame an innocent man. The identification and the fingerprint were lost amidst the arguments back and forth in court about the DNA comparison. Uhrig aggressively attacked the science, claiming it was preposterous and a parlor trick for family courts, but had no business in something as serious as criminal courts, where a man's freedom was at stake. Ashton was fighting with an arm tied behind his back because he couldn't tell the jury just how accurate the tests were. But he nonetheless argued that the methodology was sound, that the DNA from the crime scene was a clear match for Andrews, and that the jury should convict. Now, I personally think that if Ashton had taken the case to trial with just the identification and fingerprint on the windowsill, with the powerful testimony of Nancy Hodge, this case would have resulted in a conviction. But it may shock you to hear that it didn't. And before you lose your mind, Tommy Lee Andrews wasn't acquitted either. The trial ended with a hung jury. Now, we've talked about hung juries in past episodes, so we're not going to go into great detail about that here. But if you're new to the show and aren't familiar with the concept of a hung jury, this is what happens when the jury cannot come to a unanimous verdict. At least one person cannot be convinced to go along with the group and refuses to budge on their position. A verdict in a case, criminal case, must be unanimous. So even if the jury is polled at 11 to 1, they have not reached a verdict, and it's considered a hung jury. When a trial ends in a hung jury, it basically resets everything. The prosecutor can bring the case to trial all over again. And since no decision was made, double jeopardy has not set in, and the person can be put on trial again. So that's what Jeff Ashton did. He set a new date to start picking a whole new jury and begin the process all over again. But in the meantime, while waiting for the second trial to start, Ashton filed a motion seeking permission to put the statistical information in front of the new jury. And to Hal Uhrig's surprise and dismay, the judge granted Ashton's motion and decided to permit Michael Baird to testify that there was a 1 in 10 billion chance that the DNA sample was matched to someone else. Andrews was put back on trial a few months after his first case ended in a hung jury. Ashton streamlined down the presentation of the prosecution's case and tried to make it simpler. He included all the information Baird could offer with regards to the DNA, but also actively sought to make it clearer that even without the DNA evidence, the case against Andrews was still strong. Uhrig made the same arguments in the second trial, but this jury was far more willing to accept the scientific arguments. And after a very short deliberation, Tommy Lee Andrews was convicted of rape. Immediately after this conviction, Ashton scheduled Andrews' next trial, which was the attempted sexual assault and stabbing of a woman named Karen Monroe. DNA samples had also been taken from the Monroe crime scene, which were matched to Andrews. In that situation, Andrews had worn a mask and had sliced Monroe several times as he tried to sexually assault her, She was ultimately able to struggle enough that Andrews fled, but DNA evidence was left at the crime scene. Having had two trials already to work the kinks out of Baird's testimony, Ashton and Baird were now very comfortable with how to present the DNA evidence. This time, even without an identification, without fingerprints, on the strength of the DNA match alone, Tommy Lee Andrews was convicted again. He was jointly sentenced on both convictions to over 100 years in prison, but on appeal, he had his sentence reduced to around 60 years. In Florida, state offenders have one-third of their sentence reduced as built-in time off for good behavior, so long as they don't do anything while incarcerated to give the Department of Correction reason to take that benefit away. By taking educational programs and other optional offerings at the prison, some additional time off can be taken at the end of a convict's sentence. So at the end of the day, Andrews was in prison from 1988 until August of 2021, roughly 34 years. He was released early when a judge determined that his decades of incarceration without any incidents of violence or sexual aggression warranted early release. In summation, Jeff Ashton deserves a lot of credit for creative thinking and finding ways to apply out-of-the-box solutions. If it wasn't Ashton, I have a feeling some other prosecutor would have hatched the idea to use DNA comparisons in criminal cases before too long. But who knows if that person would have been able to so clearly articulate to a judge why the science is reliable enough to pass a Fry test. It's entirely possible that DNA could have gone the route of the polygraph or lie detector test. Lie detectors are not uncommon, and they're frequently used in litigation to try and convince an opposing party that a person is telling the truth. But they're not admissible in court, so whether it's a civil or criminal attorney making the argument, they cannot bring up that the person passed a polygraph at a potential trial. DNA evidence did not become a new prosecution tool in every office overnight. It was still misunderstood by many people who did not want to take the time to really comprehend it. But slowly, gradually, it became a part of crime labs all across the country, and now requires pretty strict competency regulations for crime lab techs to conduct the testing. By about the year 2000, it had become fairly commonplace in crime scene examinations and evaluations. So here's my own personal stance on DNA. DNA comparisons are now basically accepted as truth. As a defense lawyer, I frequently am not interested in truth. My job is not to bring the truth to light. Sometimes that would mean marching my client straight into a conviction. My job is to represent the interests of my client. Now sure, sometimes that does mean pushing for the truth to come out. Sometimes the truth is on my side. But often it's not. And in those cases, DNA can link my client to crimes I'm arguing that the state or federal government cannot prove was committed beyond a reasonable doubt. DNA comparisons are a tool. In my mind, the tool itself isn't good or bad, moral or immoral. That's a factor of how it's used. Prosecutors don't have a monopoly on DNA testing either. Often when a defendant maintains their innocence with their lawyer, the attorney will arrange to conduct DNA testing of their own in an effort to exclude the client as a suspect. Private labs, like the Lifecoats Corporation, will DNA test samples for private citizens for whatever reason they want. So DNA doesn't just mean guilty, it's actually far more nuanced than that. Bringing it back to Tommy Lee Andrews, I'm shocked that Hal Ulrich was able to get a hung jury in the first trial. I'm sure it helped that Jeff Ashton wasn't able to bring out how statistically reliable the data was, but still, it was a very strong case, and he managed to convince at least one juror that it was all too confusing and to hold out. Ultimately, the retrial jury and the Karen Monroe jury seemed to have got it right. It's fairly clear with hindsight that Tommy Lee Andrews was the perpetrator here. He was interviewed last year, just prior to his release. He was asked if he felt any remorse. His response was that he was factually innocent of the crimes. He denied taking part in any of the 23 sexual assaults attributed to him and claimed he had been framed, railroaded, and set up by a corrupt district attorney's office. He said he would rather remain in jail forever than admit that he had committed any of the sexual assaults. Once the Orange County judge signed his release order, there was a backlash from Hodge as well as many of the other victims. In 1988, on the strength of the original 100-year sentence, Ashton had opted not to try Andrews for the 20 or so other sexual assaults, believing that Andrews would spend the rest of his natural life in jail. However, now, those women who were victimized but did not get their day in court are understandably frustrated that Andrews is a free man, denying that he assaulted anyone. Unfortunately, not everyone is able to feel as though they've received justice in our system. So that's the origin of how DNA testing became used in criminal cases in the United States. The Casey Anthony prosecutor saw an advertisement in a magazine for paternity tests from a New York-based lab, and now DNA profiling is in virtually every law enforcement television show or movie made. For his part, outside of Orange County, Florida, Tommy Lee Andrews has managed to slip into the fog of time. I imagine very few people would be able to tell you the name of the first person convicted in America using DNA evidence, and I'm willing to bet he prefers it that way. So that's the story of how Jeff Ashton used DNA evidence to convict Tommy Lee Andrews twice, and as a result, a serial rapist spent about 34 years in jail. If you enjoyed this episode, check out the entire catalog on Apple Music, Spotify, or on the show's website, insummation.com. Also, don't forget to subscribe and get notified when new episodes come out. If you have a topic you want to cover, or a case you think would make for a good discussion, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, find Insummation on Instagram, leave comments on the show's website, or look me up at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. A special thank you, as always, to Dan Townsend, who is instrumental in keeping the show's audio quality tip-top and supplies everything you hear that isn't my voice. I also need to thank my wife, Serena, who gave me the idea to do a show on the first DNA case in the United States. I always appreciate good ideas, so thank you. That's it for Tommy Lee Andrews. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.